If you're a global company or investor looking to navigate a world defined by a pandemic and a fracturing global economy, you need a different kind of advice.
Well, he's had his lunch break with the FT, but now it's time to welcome back Alec.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed my chance to talk about lunch because it is about my favourite thing in the FT weekend. But I'm particularly glad to be back now because we're in for something of a treat. Now, Claire, I'm sure you'll agree with me that while we've loved this digital festival, if there's one thing and one thing alone that we miss, it's the chance to talk to readers in the flesh, to meet them and talk to them, particularly because one of the things that they always ask us is, well, what's it like working in the FT? How do these things happen? How does the journalism come about? Well, viewers, we can give you a little answer to that now, even in our digital festival. We are going to give you a sneak insight into the brains trust of the FT. We're going to take you to a live editorial debate. Now, Claire, you have been to these, you've been summoned to them from time to time. Can you just paint the scene?
I have. Well, I mean, the first one I went to was absolutely terrifying. I had to put across my side of the argument. I didn't know what was going to happen. Fortunately, Martin Wolf agreed with me. So after that, it was plain sailing. But the masthead of the FT is without fear and without favour. And that is the part of the FT that we're talking about. That is where these articles appear. So it's the collective opinion of all of the biggest brains in the room. So to be a fly on the wall with Rula Khalaf, our wonderful editor, she's going to be presiding over this debate, as she does every morning in the office upstairs, along with Janan Ganesh, our US political columnist, Gillian Tett, who is the chair of the FT's editorial board in the US, Sarah O'Connor, the FT's employment columnist, and, wait for it, the FT's chief economics commentator, none other than Martin Wolf.
Well, you're probably right to end with Martin Wolf, because one of my happiest memories of 4 years ago when we first launched this festival was when Martin turned up on the stage, and he was sort of greeted like a rock star, and hundreds of people were roaring and cheering. So everyone, we're about to start. You need to imagine that you're in a crowd of people roaring them on for a great impassioned debate. Over to you, Rula.
A warm welcome again to our readers and everyone else joining us. I hope you're enjoying the last day of the festival. So for the next 45 minutes or so, we're going to be showing you how we come up with FT Views. We have a few members of our editorial board. Usually we're quite a few more, and people sometimes talk over each other. It can get pretty heated, but we're going to try to be more disciplined today. Ultimately, the FT view is the view of the editor, but I do listen to arguments, and particularly to Martin, and then I make a call. So let's get going. I picked two topics for us, which I think we have to do in the next, we must be writing in the next few days anyway, and they are hot topics. So the first is taxes. We've had headlines all week about a tax bombshell that the chancellor is supposed to be about to detonate. What do we think about tax rises? What should our view be, Martin?
Well, I think it's a huge question, and it will be one of the biggest legacies, the most certain legacy, I think, of the pandemic. And I think just to open the discussion, I don't want to write this leader in my head. I just go through what I think are the issues that we have to think about. And by the way, it's crucial to stress, this is not just about Britain. All the developed countries are running fiscal deficits essentially without precedent in peacetime. So the UK will have a fiscal deficit on the most recent estimates from the Office of Budget Responsibility of about 19% of GDP this year. That's relatively high among the developed countries. But there are others in that sort of ballpark, and they're all running deficits, which basically they've never run before outside world wars. So that's the background. And as a result, debts are going to rise immensely, probably somewhere between 20 and 40 percentage points of GDP, depending on the country and so forth. So that's the background. And a result, again, for many countries, debts will be higher at the end of this than they've ever been before. That's not true for the UK, but they will be higher in the UK relative to GDP than they've been at any time since 1960. So this is a big deal. So that leads to a series of questions. First, will at some point higher taxes be necessary? And I think the answer to that is almost certainly yes. The only conditions in which that won't be true unless is if we have a colossally strong economic recovery, which is sustained, might happen, doesn't seem very likely, or we decide to do the entire fiscal adjustment through spending, which would mean austerity on steroids. And I think it's just politically impossible anywhere, even in the US, and certainly not in Britain. Do we know, second big question, do we know when or how much? And the answer is no, because we have massive uncertainty about the recovery, how strong it will be, when it will be done. But it's quite clearly not now, because we don't have to. We can borrow incredibly cheaply. We have absolutely no idea what the economy is going to look like a year or two from now. And most crucially, we want to get there as quickly as possible, so we don't want a big fiscal squeeze. That then leaves, is there any big risk in waiting? Well, the only real risk, and it's for the UK, not for the US, not for Germany, possibly Italy, though I think the ECB is behind them, is that people lose confidence in the UK. They basically decide the UK is a seller. And in that case, we could have a sterling crisis. Doesn't look very likely, but that would make life very difficult for the government. And that's why they have to show that they're responsible and sensible. Is there a good alternative to raising taxes to bring the deficit down? The best alternative, as I've said, is to get really fast growth. And we should be thinking about growth policy in this context. I don't think printing money forever, which is MMT's idea, is very sensible. We can go into that further. Austerity will not be politically acceptable. So taxes must be part of it, as I said. Then is the sixth big question, what taxes might be raised? Well, there's a lot of debate on that. We can tax bads, we should tax carbon, we should tax pollution, things like that. There's a strong case for getting rid of reliefs, VAT, corporation tax, they're all a mess. But I think there's a case for wealth taxes, but we can discuss it. But I think the really big point is this is a really big, good opportunity for serious tax reform. The IFS produced a very good note last week, I think, on that. And what the Chancellor should be doing now, since he's got a year at least before he decides what to do, is to put in process a serious discussion of the tax reforms we need to get our new green economy, which we're committed to, and more equality and all the rest, all these issues. What are the reforms we need and how would that fit into his overall plan? And I think we should be calling for that as the key part of what has to be done now, along with the commitment that in the end, we're going to go back to a sound fiscal position, but it won't be tomorrow.
So I agree with all of that. Martin, what I don't understand is why did the Treasury, I'm assuming that the Treasury floated the ideas of, about tax rises now?
Well, first of all, I don't know, and I haven't read anything that tells me. There are two possibilities. One, it was an accident. They started, I think it's unlikely, but it's possible.
I'm pretty sure.
Never be ruled out, to screw up. The second is they want to fly the kite to get the debate going and without having their own fingers on it. So, and they want to see finally what sort of political resistance there is to this idea, how they're going to have to go about this.
But we should argue that the timing is that this is the wrong time to be doing it because the demand has been much stronger than they had expected. This is not the time to be telling people, you know, there are taxes coming, especially
if people don't know. Back to my first suggestion is that it was a mistake. Now it is possible that the Chancellor is actually itching to do this, really itching, and And if so, I think it would be a rather serious mistake. But I have to say that the fact that this debate has emerged in this way in the UK, not any other developed country as far as I know, doesn't seem to be a big issue elsewhere. The Republicans aren't making a big fuss about the fiscal deficit as far as I can see. But Gillian could correct me. It's all a big puzzle, but if I may say so, there's a very great deal about British politics at the moment that I don't understand, and that's just a part.
It sounds a bit like party management here. Sarah, just to finish on what we'll say about the UK, and we'll move on to the US and broaden it. Do you agree with Martin?
I do. I mean, I also agree with you that even flying kites right now, I think is probably damaging, because at a time when consumer confidence is really fragile, I just don't think you even need to start spooking people about tax rises. It's clearly not the right time to do it. It'd be much better to say, we're going to do a big review of this. By the way, this review is going to take a year, and until then, don't worry about it. And then everyone gets the idea in their head that something's coming, but also has some sense that actually it's not coming right now. And floating sort of random bombshells here and there, I think, is kind of just a bit irresponsible and a strange way of going about it.
Almost as if they have to come up with something for the Sunday.
This
is how it now feels.
It's very weird. I agree with Sarah. The politics going on at the moment in some of these issues are really bewildering to me.
I mean, Janan understands the Tory party better than me, so maybe he could shed some light on the tactics.
Isn't Janan because they want to they're trying to figure out what they stand for in a way?
I think it's preparing parliamentary opinion for the reality of tax cuts within this parliament, probably towards the end of the parliament, because there's still another 4 years to run. But there are going to be lots of very, very upset conservative backbenchers. And I think this is the process of reconciling them to the idea of tax cuts pretty early on.
Tax increases.
Tax rises.
Sorry, tax increases. Yeah. Tax increases and to a certain extent, spending cuts. Now, we've discussed the question of when and to what extent to increase taxes. But there is the other question which Martin touched on, which is who pays, which section of society is going to ultimately bear the burden of tax increases. And I do think there's a moral case for, and I don't want to make some of my fellow panelists here reach nervously for their wallets or their purses, but there is a moral case for making the older generation bear the majority of the burden when it comes to the fiscal consolidation. What the lockdown ultimately was a huge intergenerational gesture by the young towards the old. That's not to say that COVID did not affect the young. Of course it did from a health perspective, but it was disproportionately a threat to older people. And yet the economic cost of frozen employment was borne by people in work who were disproportionately young, of course. And so the young have paid a huge cost over the past 6 months to protect the old. It was an entirely correct gesture, but that intergenerational generosity might have to be reciprocated over the next few years when it comes to the fiscal consolidation. And so the increased taxes might have to be on pensions, pension benefits, of which there are lots in the UK, and potentially asset wealth, which is, again, mainly held by older generations. So the guiding principle, I think, when it comes to the profile of tax increases might be related to age.
You've also just described the demographics of the Tory party, of course.
Predominant. It's a party predominantly made up of people who are not in work, either because they're mainly because they're retired and have asset wealth.
I think we can touch on that in terms of party management in this leader, but I think we will be writing many other leaders where we can get into it more deeply. Let's just move on to the US, because I think we do need to broaden this out a bit. Gillian?
Yeah, Rula, I'd say that I think Janan raises a very good point about thinking about where tax rises fall. And in addition to older people, there's two other groups who have essentially benefited recently. One is anyone who's holding assets that have been massively inflated by quantitative easing. Yeah. And you are essentially creating growing levels of inequality as a result of extreme quantitative easing. And I think there's a good case for looking at the fiscal system to essentially try and rectify some of that going forward. Secondly, of course, is the corporate tax world and tech companies. And there's been a lot of attention paid to the extraordinarily high profits tech companies are making. the fact they've been very adept at dodging taxation globally. That's another area where there could and should be some discussion. Tragically, in the US right now, there's not a lot of discussion about sensible tax reform. The focus is very much instead on tax cutting. And I'm sure that Janan's slip of saying cutting, not raising, indicates where he's sitting. Because, of course, you've got, you know, the Trump administration talking about payroll tax cuts, which to my mind is an insane idea, given it's not the people in work you necessarily need to help right now. And the whole idea of...
But you could think in the short term more about whether you could actually cut the taxes. Long-term rises.
There's every case to be made for extending fiscal support, but not necessarily through a payroll tax cut. That's a key point.
It has to be spending.
Yeah, and through spending or through forms of actual, you know, subsidies. There's one other big point, though, I want to return to Martin earlier about how we get out of this extraordinarily high debt burden. And it's worth going back to the period after World War II, because as Martin says, that was the last time that the Western world had this huge debt burden. Everybody should be reading or rereading about the work to do with financial repression done by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, looking at what actually cut the debt burden post-World War II. And it wasn't higher taxes, massive growth alone. It was also the fact that for a very long period of time, essentially bond yields were kept below the prevailing rate of inflation, essentially creating a subtle stealth transfer of, you know, wealth from savers to the government. I suspect that's where we're heading as well. We're going into a world of financial repression. So at some point, we need to recognize that, ask whether it's good or bad. In some ways, it's the fairest, most democratic way to actually get a debt burden reduced, one might argue, although it has other negative side benefits. But we should talk about that openly and discuss in a separate leader, do we think that's good or bad? And at least recognize it's not just all about tax rises, spending cuts, or hopefully lots of growth this time around.
So you make a good point. We can put that on our list for next week. Martin, I'm going to give you the last point on this, because I think we're coming to, you know, I want to move on to a discussion about the office.
Well, I don't have, I can go in detail in my comments and everything that's been said. On the, just a couple of important points. The old are an extraordinarily heterogeneous group. A lot of old people are very poor and have no wealth and no assets. So it's basically the old rich, the old, which means the upper middle class is rich. They are most of the, you know, most of the assets are held by people probably over 50 anyway. That's where it's going to fall. And the principle of taxation is ultimately the famous principle of the bank robber. You go where the money is. Since they have the money, that's where it's going to come from. And beyond the ethical point, that's true. Then you can start thinking about, people will be thinking about wealth taxes and income taxes. The second point is, I have a suspicion that sort of fits, and that's my last point, about the US, is the Republicans are never going to close this deficit. Contrary to everybody's hypothesis, the Republicans are consistently the more fiscally profligate party, and they will continue to be. And the Democrats have learned that every time they tighten the budget, and they've done it repeatedly, they did it under Clinton, they did it under Obama, the Republicans then spend. So they're not going to do it anyway. And the US has the dollar. So I think the US is not going to close the fiscal deficit. And that is, and given what the Fed has just announced, which is we are going to run inflation. Let's be very clear, that's what they've said. Let's assume they can do it. I think the US is going to go gangbusters. Fiscal and monetary expansion under either party and a fair amount of inflation. If they manage to raise the debt they need really long term, they're very bad about this, then they can exactly do what Gillian said, and it will crunch the dollar as a real asset. And so my prediction is 10 years from now, maybe sooner, we're going to have some serious dollar crises. But that's for a column, not for a leader. but there's a comment on what you said.
Okay, now since this is the weekend festival and we are engaging our readers, there's a question before we move on. What tax reforms would boost the government's desire to level up? Are wealth taxes the answer? This is a loaded question. We've had a lot of arguments about this in leader conference. So the same question continues. The pandemic has accelerated devolution. Shouldn't we devolve far more of taxation to both the devolved parliaments and local governments?
Shall I comment on that?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, obviously, wealth taxes are levelling down, not levelling up. And I could imagine that a government will come along. I mean, if Mr. Starmer becomes Prime Minister, I think he will be looking at that as part of policy. But it won't achieve levelling up. And that fits to the second one. Britain is extraordinary and unique, I think, in how limited the capacity for local taxation is. It's less true vis-a-vis, certainly not less true vis-a-vis Scotland. And I think that's an area which I've been arguing about this for about 20 years. We really, really do need to devolve power, and that means devolving fiscal power. To do that, however, you really have to reform the tax system, because as it is currently structured, it simply can't be delegated to local levels in any effective way. And that gets into really interesting questions. Do we have local income taxes? How do you change property taxes? Do we have local sales taxes, which many other countries have, none of which we have?
So that takes us back actually to what we want the conclusion of this leader to be, which is that we need a process in place to discuss tax reform. This is not the time to be talking, to even be signaling tax reform. Why they've been doing it is, you know, nobody can really understand. It's probably more party politics than it is economic policy. And we've got a bottom line. This is a good leader. Thank you all. Okay, let's move on to the office. You all know that I quite like the office. I like the idea of the office, but almost everyone at BFT disagrees with me. We just had a survey, in fact, in which I think the last I'd heard was out of 150 people, two people wanted to go back to the office. Obviously, this is not a leader about the FT.
And you were one of them.
Again,
And you were one of them.
I was probably one of them. But the government earlier this week also, again, tried to encourage a return to the office on the basis that there is, you know, all the retail and hospitality businesses are really suffering. And I mean, you know, I go into the city a couple of times a week and it is still pretty much deserted. However, I did see just today, one of our stories said that in the last week of August, 50% of workers had gone back, and that is up from about 30% in June. It's also very interesting to note that in cities like Paris or Berlin, it's about 85%. I mean, they are almost back to normal. So what's going on here, and do we actually need to return to the office, or as I, you know, this is what I'm sort of coming to a conclusion that perhaps the way forward is some form of a hybrid system where you may spend 2 days at home, 3 days in the office, or 3 days at home, 2 days in the office. So, Sarah, you wrote about prêt-à-manger this week and in fact advised them to hire vans and go out to the suburbs. And I think they may actually be thinking about it. They listen to you immediately.
Great. So long as they play little tunes like ice cream vans, that's my vision. I mean, to your point about why people here are not going back to the office in the same numbers as in other countries, I think it says something about the sort of dysfunctional economic geography of Britain, that so many of our good office jobs are concentrated in London, to a lesser extent places like Manchester, but largely London. House prices property prices, rents are so extortionate in London that more and more people have been forced to live further from the centre. Fundamentally, everyone has to commute in and out of this city. Public transport has always been overburdened. Everyone's always hated that. So you have a combination of factors that mean that people here are just more incentivized to stay at home. Partly the commute was unpleasant anyway. People were losing hours of their day that they could have spent with their children or doing something else more pleasant. And partly they're probably nervous about the health risks of cramming onto public transport. Coupled with that, I think there's a general mistrust of the government and everything they say in this country. Only the US, I think, suffers from that mistrust issue on the same scale.
Well, I mean, incidentally, New York, it's the same, right, Gillian?
What, in terms of people going to the office?
Yeah, nobody's going to the office in New York, are they?
People are just starting to now, to a degree, but not really. Interestingly enough, the place which is most resistant to going to the office is the West Coast. So San Francisco and LA, people are telling people pretty much universally, don't expect to go back until the summer of 2021. And that's essentially feeding back into the tech world and the media world. But what's very interesting is that I wrote a column, in fact, just a couple of days ago about what this means for banks and bank trading floors. Mm-hmm. And a lot of bankers at this very moment are doing intensive brainstorming inside the financial institutions, looking at what's happened on their trading floors in recent months and what it means going forward. And
there was a great quote in your column. It said something like, you don't know what conversation you're missing.
Well, the first point to make is that JP Morgan have come out and said that they are going to run a rotation system permanently, probably, i.e. they're not going back to life before COVID, and that people will be cycling in and out the office. But they've done that while also saying that they're going to think very, very seriously, do an amateur anthropology or sociology experiment on how you get people interacting inside the office. And what they've realized, which is so important, because I think most of us know this at the FT, and most of the watchers will know this too, close-knit teams inside offices, if they have enough social capital inside that group, you can transfer that onto Zoom, and you carry on communicating inside your team. But the real value in office is what people call incidental information exchange. It's a kind of bumping into people in the corridor, talking to people outside your team. And so the really big question is, how do you replicate that either online or through some kind of rotational hybrid system? And I think that's what people are really missing. It's that kind of lateral vision above all else. And there are all kinds of techniques being developed, but I think in The Leader, we should be saying very explicitly, the key function of the office is not just general corporate culture or solidarity or getting out of the house or having rituals for work. It's about incidental information exchange. And incidental information exchange is more important than ever in a polarized world where most professions encourage us to think in tunnels. And unless we consciously try to widen our vision, we end up suffering. So that's what I think.
Before I go to Janana Martin, I just wanted to get to, I interrupted you, Sarah. I think you were getting to the prêt-à-manger point, right?
Oh yeah, only that, yes, there is a cost to people not going into the office, which, you know, Pret is kind of emblematic of that cost because their business model was so incredibly concentrated in central London. But also there are opportunities, and particularly for countries like the UK, which have been far too concentrated into these like small geographic areas, is that the well-paid people can spread further out into the country, and that has all kinds of useful rebalancing effects. And so I don't think we should even want to go back to the way things were. I don't think the way things were was really working. It wasn't working for the rest of the country, and it wasn't working for those of us who live and work in London either.
We've got two separate issues here. One is, corporate culture and also creativity, serendipity. And then there's the economic aspect of it. Janan, you've never really worked in the office, right?
I saw him there once or twice.
Yeah, I've never been to Bracken House, which gives you an indication. But I'm skeptical of a few things here. One is that we can tell anything about British economic geography from what's going on. France is as dependent on Paris as the UK is on London. I think the Île-de-France region where Paris is accounts for a bigger share of French GDP than London does of British GDP. But as Rula said, we're already back to 85% office occupancy in Paris. The reason we're slightly behind the curve on Paris, I think, is simply that we have a worse government. And so there's been mixed messaging compared to some other Western governments. The other thing I'm skeptical about is that this is in the interests of workers, that working from home in the long term is in the interests of actual working people. At some point, it is going to dawn on working people that if your job can be done from home, it can be done from Hyderabad, it can be done from Warsaw, it can be done from Cape Town. The only thing that saves people from truly global wage competition is the office or the factory, you know, some kind of physical workplace. Without that, it's a totally open global marketplace for labor. And if a company hires someone in India or Poland or wherever, they do not count even in the UK immigration figures because they won't be living in the UK. So there's almost no upper limit to the extent to which workforces can be offshored as a result of working from home. So I will not be shocked if in a year's time, a lot of trade unions, a lot of working people, including us, come around to the idea that the office quite matters because it does protect us from a completely Hobbesian, brutal free market competition for labor. But the final thing that I'm skeptical of, and that's what Gillian...
It depends on industry, doesn't it, Sanam? I don't think we would...
Well, I think we'd be safer than most.
Yeah.
But there are lots of jobs where as long as someone can speak English and has the transferable intelligence to be trained up to do the job in question, if it's not going to be in a physical office, it may as well be done from another continent.
I think the tech industry in particular, actually.
Yeah. But just the last thing I was skeptical of, and Gillian hints at it, is this idea that businesses come out with that working from home works and there haven't been any significant costs. I think there are costs and they're just invisible and cumulative. They have not manifested in the crisis within the first 6 months. But I think there are lots of little bits of management and accountability, little conversations that are not taking place that will aggregate and manifest in mini disasters or major disasters probably next year. And I think the FT will spend a lot of 2021 covering a spate of corporate mishaps to do with working from home.
Martin?
I think Janan, well, everybody's raised some very, very important questions. So my general view on questions like this is we don't know. My second view is change is normally less, and so the less in the short run and more in the long run than we think. So we've had a huge shock out, but I suspect we will substantially, and this is a prediction, go back to the office over the next few years. They're not all the way back to where we were before. There are some things we've learned. We don't need to be there 5 days a week. But I actually wrote quite a bit about the topic that Janan has raised before the COVID-19 ever happened, largely because a friend of mine wrote what I think is a very, very interesting book under an utterly hideous title, which is Globotics. Which explored this in some detail, how the mixture of AI on the one hand and remote working on the other, supercharged in various ways, could completely transform life. Because now we're in a world in which competition will not be for jobs in manufacturing, but for jobs in quite high level services. And the only comment I'd make on what Janan said is, actually going back to the office won't save us because the underlying economics are there. So that's one set of issues that seems to me very, very important. The second, quite different point, why I think we will probably finally have to go back, and where I sort of align with Janan for a slightly different reason in this case, which is, fits in with also what Gillian said, which is an existing team of people who know one another very well, like this little group, can work pretty well online over quite a long period. But we in the FT have a very specific culture, which we've developed over decades. We're all aware we're part of it. And over time, people have to move on. And young people will come in, lots of young people, we hope. And they have to become part of this. They have to understand what this place is about. And this must apply to many other the law, everything else, which is a huge amount of tacit knowledge and relations. And that cannot happen without physical interaction, without being with other people. Human beings, I think, need that very, very much. So over time, if we're going to retain organization, there's an organizational cultural core to a business. And without that, I don't think they're going to survive anyway. If they don't have that, then that requires some systematic face-to-face interaction to keep going over time. And for that reason, the office in some form or other will remain a central part of our lives if we have viable organizations.
I think you're making a very good point. I think, and Janan touched on this too, because my worry's been on, you know, younger people coming into the business. And this isn't just in journalism, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
How do they understand what the organization is about? And also, how do you even train people online? The other point is about management. It does take an awful lot more management. And so unless you're a very layered and bureaucratic organization, it can be tougher. And I think, Janan, your idea about there will be certain disasters because we don't know it yet. No. And maybe we also don't know that it has to do with remote working, but it's, you know, it is an issue. On the other hand, yes, people have discovered also a different way of living, and that's important. They've discovered that they can spend more time with their families and with their kids, and perhaps even, you know, live a bit farther from the city if they don't have to come back in. And I think somehow we have to reconcile all of this. Gillian, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I was going to say, Rula, in terms of writing this leader, one way to frame it might be to highlight the irony that the roots of the word technology don't actually mean skill with numbers or brilliant computer with computer codes. It means skill with words, skill with knowledge. And so much of what offices do is essentially create an apprenticeship type model for bringing in young people. And in spite of all the money we put spending on degrees and training and online digital, at the end of the day, apprenticeship style training, watching other people, absorbing a culture, being human, is actually critical. So in some ways, what COVID-19 has done is shown us that even in a cyber age, or maybe especially in a cyber age, we're still human and social interaction really matters. And that, at the end of the day, is a real value of an office.
Do you all miss being in the office, by the way?
Yeah, I miss it. But no, I wouldn't want to go back 5 days a week.
But I don't miss being in the office at all, but I miss having regular interactions with my colleagues. Mm. And this isn't quite the same. So I wouldn't mind coming in for lunch quite regularly. but then I'm at the opposite end of the apprenticeship process, putting it mildly. But I just want to express Gillian's point that I've been involved in leaders for 33 years. God. And I think a lot of through over the time, there have been a lot of young leader writers, some of whom are now very well-known writers at the FT. And I suspect if you asked any of them, Tim Harford or Robin Harding, people like this, that about their first year or two, three, they would say the interaction with senior people, the constant discussion with in the halls, in the cafeteria, so forth, with senior people helped them immensely to learn what was expected. And of course, they went into their career. And I think that is a central part of what an institution like ours, and I assume McKinsey and all the others, is about.
Yeah, I just add to that. I mean, I was a graduate trainee at the FT in 2007, and Gillian Tett was my first line manager during the credit crunch. And that was, you know, at the risk of brown nosing, that was a phenomenal apprenticeship in journalism. And it would not have been the same if I'd been doing it over Zoom. So we have to find some way that we enable hybrid working that also allows us to train up young people in a face-to-face way.
Yeah, I really like the way this leader is going. We've got a couple of questions. Gillian, following what you said about the office's value in exchanging incidental information, wasn't a lot of that lost with the demise of Fleet Street?
The answer is yes, some of it was lost with the demise of Fleet Street. But at the same time, most media groups still have some physical locations where they meet. And also what has been given since the demise of Fleet Street is this unbelievable ability to snoop on other pools of information. Today, if you have the will, you can, from your desk or through talking, colliding with other people, following people on Twitter, things like that, suddenly get a window into 100,000 different worlds that you wouldn't have been able to easily get into before. I mean, you know, I know people who are going undercover and populating far right chat rooms right now to understand the mind of the alt-right. That kind of thing you couldn't do in the past. But the critical point is this: you have to deliberately choose it. It doesn't come to you, because the tide and current of our current world for media and business and so much else is to force us into tunnels. And the algorithms online actually encourage that. So in journalism, like everywhere else, we have to take active steps to get out of those tunnels. The office can do that in some ways, but otherwise journalists have to find other alternative mechanisms too, like everyone else.
Yeah, that's a very good answer, because what we didn't have in the past is social media and the ability to actually find out about an awful lot without leaving our desk. I do worry that a lot of people now rely a bit too much on social media, and it does end up being an echo chamber, doesn't it? As you were saying, the tunnels.
We have to choose. And personally, I'm passionately of the view that if we're going to teach kids in school, and I hope we are teaching them all, about cyber hygiene, cyber hacking, cyber bullying, cyber security, we have to teach them about cyber tribalism and actively tell them from day one, you are going to have to go out individually and try and search out the other, a different point of view. Get out of tunnel vision, embrace lateral vision. And I hope as a newspaper, we actually can support that message and hammer it home through leaders as well, because I think that's absolutely critical to actually trying to build a better civic culture in the future.
Absolutely. So another question is, does remote hiring not allow for really hiring the best person for the role a business is hiring for?
Well, the argument, it follows on from Janan's point, doesn't it? And it's an interesting point. Let's suppose you were looking for the best writer on economics in the world, and you could have hired someone anywhere, and that person wouldn't have to move. Would that not, in principle, make for a better organization? By the way, I actually think we're in that situation now. We could do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, we could do that now anyway.
But we do that.
It's going to be much easier now because of the technology, the interaction. I mean, 10 years ago, you couldn't interact with that person in the way that we can now interact. And that would make, as Janan said, there are lots of jobs which can now be done by someone in India or France, Australia or whatever.
With some connection to the office, Martin, you know, regular visits but yes. Definitely.
That is, Oprah, we do operate across three continents.
Janan, do you want to come in?
Yeah, we can. And for many years, we've been able to hire a writer anywhere in the world because it can be done remotely. What's going to change if working from home normalizes is that almost any type of business will be able to do that. So if you are Accenture or Clifford Chance, at the moment, you're London office hires people who live in and around London. As long as you can find someone in an English-speaking country who has a degree or has the transferable intelligence to be trained up as an auditor, accountant, lawyer, whatever, programmer, suddenly the barriers to entry to the labor market are literally zero. And I can't stress enough, they will not count into UK immigration figures. So there is no juridical problem when it comes to having a staff that is 80% non-UK based, even though the profits are ultimately being booked in London. So the implications for labour competition really are seismic, I think. And maybe we struggle to get it because we're already in a business that's relatively globalised and can hire people anywhere. But there are lots of businesses which would start doing that for the first time if working from home became the absolute norm. The other thing I would stress is that I'm not sure we can ever really arrive at a satisfactory hybrid, because it will create all sorts of internal office politics problems. to do with who gets to stay at home and who doesn't, who gets the voluntary option and who doesn't, which jobs absolutely have to be based in the office at least some of the time and which ones aren't. And one way of avoiding a lot of that schism and that kind of political awkwardness is that you mandate a common line, which is that most people have to be in the office most of the time. And if I were running an investment fund, and thank God I'm not, but if I were running an investment fund, I would buy office space in about a year's time or 18 months' time when it hits the floor, because I think it will resurge over the next 5 years.
I think that, I mean, from the people that I've been talking to, I think a lot of companies will sort of mandate 2 days a week. But what we haven't talked about here is the when, because without a vaccine, you can't, I think no company can really make people go back to the office, even for 1 day a week, right? So I know a lot of people are sort of dipping in, trying, you know, they're bored at home, they're coming in for lunch. But I do think that we're talking, you know, next year rather than this year.
Oh, yeah, yeah, at least next year, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that we can, you know, we can say that the office is not dead, it probably will not come back in the same form, at least in some countries, and that get into all the organization, cultural aspects, but also the economic aspects that Sarah pointed to. I think we're pretty much in agreement now, kind of. We've got half a second and one question that says, you're having a Zoom conference, editorial conference. What does it lack that an in-person one doesn't? So I would say what it lacks is that quite often Martin will come in 2 minutes later and say, I have 10 minutes to discuss, and then disappear. What else is it lacking, Janan, Sarah, Gillian?
He's quite right. You're quite right. You can't control your time properly this way. You're really trapped.
You're stuck.
It's so rude just to disappear it somehow.
No, you can pretend there's technical difficulties.
I'm going to move in that direction. Janan made an unbelievably important point, which I want to hammer, which is we're at the end of real globalization, but virtual globalization has just begun.
Yeah, we've been thinking of writing a leader. I think that will, I'm going to come back to that next week. Anything else, very quickly?
I'd argue one thing it lacks, though, is we're not traveling around so much. And the fact that so many people are no longer traveling means that for many of us, our geographical horizons have collapsed inwards. And what I notice is a trend towards parochialism amongst the, you know, anyone who used to be more global. And it's harder to actually imagine and empathize with other parts of the world now because we're simply not going to be there.
Okay, well, thanks everyone. We've got two great leaders. Now the only question is who's going to write them, but we can discuss this on Monday. Bye everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks for watching.
Thank you, Rula. Thank you, leader writers, Janan, Gillian, Sarah, Martin. It took me back to my very first experiences of leader conference. And I think, viewers, you should just bear in mind one thing. I know they looked really happy, cheery, and it's all very relaxed. But let me tell you, when you're in that room for real, it can actually be really quite scary because you have some very strong opinions being expressed, and they're expressed incredibly forcefully, Claire, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the first one that I went into was a total culture shock. I mean, it was like a school debating competition on acid. Really was quite ferocious,
and
all of a sudden I just didn't feel quite sure of my opinions. But I think that in the debate that we've just seen, they were quite restrained. Certainly there's been a few fists on the tables and, you know, people getting really impassioned about their points. But they did cover a really broad range of quite tricky topics. I mean, I think tax, again, has been a theme, but that was one thing that they all seem to agree on, that there has to be some kind of reform to the way that we tax things, particularly in the UK. But then Janan's point was particularly controversial, that, you know, we might have to tax the older generation more, given that they've got more money and the younger generation have suffered to protect them during the pandemic. Now, a controversial view, but that's what Leader Conference is all about.
Well, too right. And that interjection by Janan actually reminded me of the big dilemma that the editor ruler faces every day, which is you want to say something strong, confident, that is really making a point. You don't really want to have that sort of traditionally much lampooned centrist leader that newspapers loved to do 20, 30 years ago. On the one hand, on the other hand, and then you sort of end by saying, well, one thing's
sure,
it's a bit too soon to tell, and then everyone's, oh, it's just, it doesn't work now, and it really doesn't work in the digital age either. It sort of worked for print readers, I think, doesn't work digitally. So that is the real difficulty for Ruler. They are there. We're now turning to something rather different. Stick around, viewers. We're going to the Romantics.
If you're a global company or investor looking to navigate a world defined by a pandemic and a fracturing global economy, you need a different kind of advice.